Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 6, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call discussing the new book from Professor Henry Now titled Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today's conversation will be moderated by Matthew Hyman, and I'll stop here to allow him to make further introductions. We expect to take questions from our audience at around the 40-minute mark of today's program. With that, Mr. Hyman, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Will, and thanks to all those that have dialed in. We're fortunate to be joined today by Henry Now. Henry Now is Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. He holds a BA degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a master's in PhD from John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Professor Now was a public servant in both the State Department and as a staff member at the National Security Council, and he's also an Army veteran. And as Will mentioned at the top, he's written the book that we'll be focusing on today. He's written a number of books in the area of international affairs and diplomacy, but we will be focusing on conservative internationalism, which was issued, which was published a few years ago, and then a paperback version with a new preface just came out just shy of a year ago. So, Professor Now, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Matt. It's good to be with you, and hello to the audience.
So, plenty to talk about given current events, and I thought maybe we could start with a framing question, which is, it's obviously laid out in some detail in your book, but I'm wondering if you could sketch for the audience how you define conservative internationalism. You know, what does that mean to you? And then how do you differentiate it from some of the other major schools of thought in foreign policy?
No, it's a great question to start with. You know, there are three standard traditions for thinking about America's role in the world, and they've actually been around, you could argue, since the beginning of the Republic. There is an internationalist position, which was associated with Thomas Jefferson's views, which argued that we could significantly change the nature of the international system. He was a big proponent of what he called peaceful trade, peaceful commerce, and he was an admirer of the early revolution in France. So with the expectation, sort of the Immanuel Kant expectation, that republics would change the way in which countries interacted with one another and we could get beyond the balance of power. Realists are the second sort of major tradition in American foreign policy, and they trace their origins back to Alexander Hamilton, who believed in the balance of power and who thought that that was the only way you could really deal with the world, with the external world, and favored alliances in his time, an alliance with Great Britain as the best means for securing America's freedom. And then finally, probably George Washington, the nationalists are the third tradition, in some prominence again today, by the way, as we'll talk about later. But Washington's view was that we should, by all means, preserve our independence and not get drawn into alliances or not expect to do that much in international affairs. We should take care of ourselves and our own security, and other people would take care of their security. So those traditions have been around. Now, the internationalists distinguish themselves from the nationalists and the realists in terms of what they think we can achieve in foreign affairs, the goals of foreign affairs. Internationalists believe that, in fact, we can make the world a better place. We can get beyond the balance of power. Nationalists and realists really don't think that's possible. They think the world's always going to be anarchic, decentralized, and the best we can do is to protect our national interests in that context. Realists are a little more expansive in terms of their desire to stabilize major regions of the world. Nationalists are principally concerned just about protecting the defense of the borders and the immediate sea lanes of the United States. Now, internationalists, on the other hand, there are two different kinds of internationalists, and until recently, one of them has not been as prominent as the other. That's liberal internationalists and then the conservative internationalists. Now, the liberal internationalists, they both, by the way, share the expectation that we can make the world a better place, but they go about it in very different ways. The liberal internationalists, and they're identified with originally, as I suggested, maybe Thomas Jefferson, but then more recently, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt. They believe that the best way to move forward in making the world a better place is to organize it institutionally. That is, through diplomacy, through negotiations, through setting up procedures and processes in the international system whereby we deal every day with issues with other countries. And we acquire in that process a habit of cooperation. And their view is that if we can do that over a sustained period of time through organizations like the League of Nations, which Woodrow Wilson, of course, inspired, and the United Nations, which Franklin Roosevelt inspired, if we do that over time, countries will come around to sort of the pluralist compromise way of doing business, and maybe eventually will themselves become more open and democratic. Now, conservative internationalists are more doubtful about that. They want to achieve the same goal, that is to bring other countries around to more open and pluralist politics, but they doubt that non-democracies are going to cooperate with democracies in international institutions to achieve that purpose, and that non-democracies may very well continue to practice the balance of power outside of those negotiations, and may achieve their objectives, therefore, while they are pretending to negotiate with democracies in the context of international institutions. So conservative internationalists, and I trace them back in the book, I ultimately argue that Thomas Jefferson was such a conservative internationalist, but more recently, Harry Truman, and most importantly, Ronald Reagan represent this point of view. They think that, you know, we're going to have to use some military and economic leverage in order to move non-democratic countries more steadily in a direction of a more democratic world. And so they place a little more emphasis on the use of force while negotiations are going on, whereas liberal internationalists, and think of President Obama, for example, are usually interested in avoiding the use of force, any use of force, until negotiations fail. And so that's an important difference between liberal internationalists and conservative internationalists in how you negotiate with countries that are not democratic and who, by the way, are often more inclined to use force, certainly domestically against their own publics, but also potentially internationally.
So, and as you noted in your book, you point out that Jefferson and Polk and Truman and Reagan were all examples of conservative internationalism, this notion that you need a blend of a use of force, economic incentives to leverage a position, then as well as, you know, some notion of compromise or at least recognizing limitations in our ability to project power and influence. I'm just wondering, obviously you highlighted the four in the book, and if folks have not read the book, I'd encourage you to get it because I think it's a nice summary of their approach and how it fits within this kind of framework. As you think, maybe as you're writing the book, Professor Now, or as you've reflected on it since the publication, are there other presidents that might fit in that framework, at least whole or in part? And two that come to my mind might be Teddy Roosevelt or, in maybe a slightly different way, someone like Nixon. I'm just wondering, would you put those in that framework, or do you say, no, they don't qualify, and if they don't, why would you say they don't qualify?
Right. No, it's another excellent question. Let me first explain why I chose to look at the four presidents that I did look at, Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. Frankly, my initial reason was because these four presidents did more, you could argue, at least on their watch, more was accomplished in terms of spreading freedom and therefore making the world a freer and more democratic and hopefully therefore more peaceful world than any other presidents. I mean, Jefferson obviously expanded the domain of freedom by, you know, he doubled the size of the country with the Louisiana Purchase. And he did that with a sense that that was going to expand the republic that he was engaged in building, that is, a free society that didn't depend upon the authority of a king or of a church. Very original experiment, by the way, that we were engaged in. Polk expanded the country then by another third, all right, when he secured in 4 short years both the Southwest Territories and the Northwest Territories. In the process, of course, engaging in war with Mexico, but resolving the issues peacefully with Britain in the case of the Northwest Territories. Harry Truman, because for the first time under Harry Truman, we decided that we needed to worry about the existence and the spread of freedom in Europe, that we could not any longer stay out of Europe and hope that it wouldn't bother us over here in this hemisphere. So he staked out the initial containment policy that said, look, we're going to protect democracy and do what we can to nurture it here in Europe and not simply go back home again as we did after World War I. Reagan, you could argue, then ultimately completed that process of expanding freedom in Europe. Truman saved freedom in Europe. Reagan ultimately made it possible for freedom to expand throughout Europe. So the question in my mind was, what did these four presidents do? Were they just lucky? Did this just happen on their watch? Or was there something about their policies that enabled them to accomplish these significant sort of expansions of freedom in the world? Now, I think they are still, after a lot of thought about this, I think they're still the ones that best represent the tradition. They do, by the way, of course, as you'll see in the book, they do share a certain common approach to policy. And that is, I think, more reflective of a conservative internationalist tradition than of any of the other three traditions. But they are not the only ones. There could be others. I did consider at one point John F. Kennedy, for example, but he was because he talked a lot about freedom and about bearing the burden and paying the price of expanding freedom in the world, defending and expanding freedom in the world. But ultimately, his time in office was so short that there was insufficient evidence really to answer the question. I think the two you mentioned are ones that I considered. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt is potentially one that would actually fit, but Roosevelt didn't really think about the world in terms of democracy, as Woodrow Wilson later did. He thought about the world primarily in terms of civilizations. And in that context, he thought about our civilization as being superior to other civilizations. So he was a real advocate of Western civilization and really was part of kind of a spirit of that time of social Darwinism, where countries were kind of competing with one another in terms of whose culture would survive, whose culture was the fittest. But he did think about making the world a better place, but in this case by simply spreading Western civilization rather than spreading sort of common democratic principles. He was an advocate of the use of force. There he revealed his kind of realist propensities. I think he was maybe a little bit too early for to represent the tradition in its clearest form. Nixon, I think I have less trouble classifying Nixon primarily as a realist. That is, he didn't believe that ideology should play a significant role in relations among countries. And he practiced that, obviously, in his desire to cooperate with the Soviet Union and to undertake détente with the Soviet Union. The idea was to coexist, in his view, probably permanently with the Soviet Union, not to try to change fundamentally the balance between freedom and communism. And he, of course, practiced it also in his relationship with China. When he went to China and sat down with Mao, one of the first things he said to Mao was, look, let's don't talk about philosophy. That doesn't really matter. What we should talk about are our common interests, our common geopolitical interests. And, of course, at that time, we both had a common interest against the Soviet Union. So Nixon, I think, is pretty clearly regarded as a realist. But it's a very interesting question to ask about other presidents. I have my students doing that from time to time. Lincoln, I think, is, by the way, a fascinating person to look at in this regard. Now, he didn't get involved in the international use of force, but if you think of the war between the states as an international war, which to some extent you can do, you can apply some of the same criteria for analyzing the presidency of Abraham Lincoln.
So if I sort of put one more president to you, mm-hmm. and that would be George W. Bush, clearly
right.
an advocate for freedom, clearly had a freedom agenda, but your book was published well after his administration had ended, and in your view, he was not considered a conservative internationalist.
Right.
Why was that?
Yeah, I explain that in the book, and it's an interpretation which I don't which can easily be argued. I argue that he was ultimately a nationalist. That is, if you take a look at his views before he came into office and the views on which he campaigned in 1980, there are some very clear signs of sort of a nationalist orientation. He wanted a more humble foreign policy. He was very much opposed to Clinton's policies of getting involved in all kinds of diplomatic negotiations around the world, peacemaking and peacekeeping negotiations. He argued strenuously in his debates with Al Gore against nation building or any notion that somehow or other we had an obligation to promote democracy. Now, I sort of take that as kind of the true feelings of George W. Bush. Now, 9/11 occurs, of course, in the first year of his presidency. And in one sense, it confirms his views as a nationalist. That is, he reacts exactly the way nationalists react to an attack upon the United States. Nationalists generally say, look, you take care of yourself, we'll take care of ourselves, and just don't do anything to us, and we won't do anything to you. But if you do something to us, if you attack us, watch out, we're coming. You'll hear us coming. You remember that comment that Bush made through the bullhorn. Now, what nationalists then usually do is they respond to the attack, but with no other purpose really than to win a military victory. Mission accomplished. George Bush, again, they had no sense, George W. Bush at that point had no sense of how he was going to use this victory, this military victory, for diplomatic purposes and for an objective of trying to exploit the occasion for strengthening democracy and maybe spreading democracy in the region. Now, he did talk about democracy, promoting democracy, before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But you remember the principal motivation for invading Iraq in 2003, according to George W. Bush, was the proliferation of nuclear weapons. When we got into Iraq and found no nuclear weapons, in some sense, now he started to emphasize the need to nation build and to promote democracy in Iraq. Now, I think he was sincere in all of these efforts, but I think he became more enthusiastic about it after it became clear that sort of his basic geopolitical reason for invading Iraq was not valid. He took 3 years to put a government in place in Iraq. I mean, he had no plans for that, and that's a real, I think, a typical sort of way in which a nationalist would behave. And it took him 4 years to launch a Middle East peace initiative. He didn't do that until November of 2007. His father initiated a Middle East peace initiative 6 months after the first Persian Gulf War. All right, a more of a sense of what are we going to do with this military victory. So I think you can argue, and again, as I say, it's an interpretation that one can disagree with, that at heart, George W. Bush was a nationalist, that he his biggest failing in Iraq followed from those nationalist leanings. He didn't have a diplomatic plan for how to exploit the leverage that he had developed through his military victory and to some extent created some of the difficulties. He, by the way, ended his term with a second military surge. So in the end, there was nothing more to do because we had squandered the first military surge was to, in fact, initiate a second military surge. So it's a little bit unfair to George W. Bush, but because I do think he was a sincere person, I think, he did the best he could. But a lot of people think maybe his principal failing was that he did not have a plan for how to connect his diplomacy, his arms, and his military leverage after the war in 2003 to a program of peaceful change in the region.
Which, as you argue in the book, that's the hallmark of conservative internationalism, is being able to link the military power with the diplomatic, sort of a muscular diplomatic approach, and then also seeing limitations, or recognizing
yes.
that there are limits to all of this, and there's only so far you should go.
Exactly.
As you think about as you framed it, the conservative internationalist tradition, obviously you cited the other traditions, nationalism being one, realism being another, and then I guess the cousin of conservative internationalism might be the liberal internationalism.
Mm-hmm.
As you think about those other traditions, is there sort of a time and place for each depending on events, or would you say that the country benefits from having had presidents that come from different traditions, or are you of a mind that on balance we're better off kind of pursuing the conservative internationalist course, or I'm just wondering how you sort of square that with
it's a wonderful question, because there could be circumstances under which one or another of these traditions makes more sense than the other traditions. I approached it a little bit differently. I approached it with the idea that, look, it may be difficult to determine what those circumstances are objectively. And what's more important is for us to have all of these traditions represented vigorously in the debate about American foreign policy at any given point of time, because then the discussion in the public square is most likely to result in a decision by the government, by the people, that will perhaps most closely track the circumstances of the time. So we may not know objectively what those circumstances are, but we may approach a policy to deal with those circumstances best through a balanced debate among these traditions. So I'm very explicit about that in the book. I'm not trying to argue against these other traditions. I think they are admirable. They have played an important role. I mean, think, for example, of Woodrow Wilson and his very, bold program to create the first international institution, multilateral, universal international institution to deal with diplomatic affairs, to deal with world affairs. Didn't succeed, but by golly, after World War II, with some modifications introduced by Franklin Roosevelt, the United Nations worked for a while, didn't manage necessarily the great power relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. But once that relationship was resolved, once that conflict was resolved, the United Nations stepped up in 1991 and conducted the first and the only so far collective security operation in the history of the world, just as Woodrow Wilson had envisioned it. That is, it went to war against Saddam Hussein after a long period of diplomacy to try to impose sanctions on him and to get him to do things through peaceful means. But then when that was unsuccessful, the world as a whole, including the Soviet Union at the time, agreed that it was necessary to use force. And so that first war in the Persian Gulf was conducted by a universal institution. So there may be occasions in the future where that again might work, where you use force only as a last resort and then only with multilateral consent, but it's not going to be always appropriate. Nationalists, I mentioned earlier that they are now maybe more prominent in the debate, haven't been in recent decades, but now they have kind of reasserted themselves. And they represent a very respectable tradition in the debate and conduct of American foreign policy. The tradition goes back to George Washington, as I mentioned, but then very specifically to Andrew Jackson, who is regarded as kind of the godfather of the nationalist tradition. So analyst, for example, like Walter Russell Mead, talks about the nationalists in his book, Special Providence. He talks about them as Jacksonians. And he makes the case that we need them. We need them in the arena when we are debating and when we are conducting American foreign policy, because they are, to some extent, the engine. They're the enthusiasm. They're the warriors, in some sense, behind American foreign policy. So if you get into a scrap, you want those Jacksonians to be there. Now, in peaceful times, maybe they can be a problem, or at least they can be a problem for the other traditions. because they then are more likely to say, we don't need to be involved in the world. We don't need to worry about what's going on in Europe or Asia. Let's bring our troops home. What are we doing protecting countries that are wealthy and can take care of themselves? Why do we need a free trade community? Let's bring our jobs back home. We need them here. So they tend to then be very isolationist, you could say, in peacetime. And while they're is an argument to be made for that, I think at least twice in our history it's proved not to be a very enduring approach. I'm thinking of a period before World War I when we tried to stay out of the war and tried to stay out of the conflicts in Europe, and then, of course, most importantly, in the 1930s when we tried to stay out, and the only result was eventually we got clobbered. So there's the possibility, and I think we need the other traditions to make us aware of this, the possibility that if we embark on a nationalist course today, we may very well be setting ourselves up to get clobbered again at some point later down the line.
Well, speaking of that, I think you probably, excuse me, you probably anticipated this next question, and that is, with Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee for the Republicans, and Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee for the Democrats, I'm wondering, how do you assess their foreign policy? Or put another way, if you were writing about them some years after an administration, where do you think they would fit within the various traditions that you've articulated?
Right. Well, I think I think it's fairly clear to me, at least at this stage, and obviously I don't know what I will say at 8 years or 4 years, but it's fairly clear to me what they are at this point. I mean, I think Donald Trump is quite clearly a nationalist in his thinking about America's role in the world. He is harking back to some of the, you know, and isolationist is often a pejorative term, but harking back to some of the, more insulary policies that we practiced in the 1930s. That is, he regards some of our alliances, NATO in particular, as being obsolete. He thinks they either need to be restructured or done away with. We don't need them. Other countries can protect themselves, especially the wealthy countries of Europe and Japan. He's got an argument there, by the way. It's just, you know, what are the consequences of pulling back? But he wants to do that. He also wants to, kind of unravel or to some extent roll back the extent of interdependence and globalization in world markets. And he advocates higher tariffs on imports into the United States, and he advocates taking jobs back from overseas and bringing them back to the United States. Now, those are traditional sort of nationalist positions on both national security and on the global economy. He may modify or moderate some of these views as the campaign develops, and certainly when he gets into office, I would think that he would look again at, you know, the question of whether you want to. You certainly might want to reform NATO, but you don't want to do that with the prospect that the only other alternative is to get rid of it. Because then you're probably not going to be terribly persistent and effective in your efforts to reform it. But my guess is that, or my hope is that he would think twice about that. He would think twice about, you know, the fact that he can get along great with Putin, even though it is Vladimir Putin, the head of Russia, even though Vladimir Putin is clearly acting very aggressively in a military way, in a way that we haven't seen for 70 years since World War II, by invading countries as he did, seizing Crimea and now destabilizing the eastern part of Ukraine. And by the way, building up large military forces now along the borders with the Baltic states, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. I mean, there's some very troubling things there. The only way to react to that is through a strengthening of NATO and through an armed diplomacy. vis-a-vis Russia, as I would call for in the case of a conservative internationalist. So he may moderate some of these views, may even moderate some of his trade views, but right now he's taking positions that can very clearly be identified as nationalist. Hillary Clinton is maybe a little more interesting. I mean, although in fact I think she's probably not that different from President Obama, and both of them would qualify in large measure as liberal internationalists, that is, as people who believe that you can achieve most of what you desire in international affairs through persistent negotiations. You just keep negotiating. You hang in there and basically persuade other countries eventually to trust you enough to make some kind of a deal with you. You refrain from using any military force in that in those negotiations, as Obama did, for example, in the negotiations with Iran. Even though Iran was using force, by the way, they were using force to support terrorists in the Middle East. They were using force to build and continue to build their nuclear program during the negotiations. But we refrained from it on the assumption that that would just increase distrust and make it harder to get an agreement. Obama then actually argued that after we got the agreement, then we would see the moderation in Iranian policy. And that's a typical kind of liberal internationalist way of thinking. You get agreements first, and then that will eventually habituate people into dealing with problems peacefully, and that will moderate then their military actions. Now, Hillary Clinton, in a couple of occasions, seemed to favor a little more use of muscle, military muscle, than President Obama. That was true in the case of Syria, where she argued that we should have armed and given more direct assistance to the opposition, to the moderate opposition forces in Syria. And she argued very strenuously, you know, for our intervention in Libya, where Obama was a little bit more on the fence, eventually persuaded by Hillary Clinton and others to undertake that intervention. So, but in the end, she is not going to be willing to make significant reforms in America's military capabilities or to apply American force, military force, in significant ways to influence her diplomacy. And her objectives are very much what you would expect from a liberal internationalist. That is, they're the common interests of climate change, of, you know, organizing a better energy resource capability in the international system, non-proliferation. These are traditional kind of common interests as perceived by liberal internationalists, not sort of the national security or the alliance objectives that you would expect nationalists and realists and maybe also conservative internationalists to support.
Well, and if we think about conservative internationalism, which in this, at least this electoral cycle does not seem to have a representative running, but if it sounds to me like you would say that's probably the, in the main, the better framework to guide foreign policy. How do you go about promoting it in times like these? And by that I mean there seems to be a growing disenchantment with, you could call it globalization or international trade. There seems to be strong questions around national security and intelligence. So if you've got a populace, or at least a large measure of the populace that has real questions about the benefits of these kinds of activities, be it on the national security side or the economic side, where does that leave someone that thinks that conservative internationalism is the better way to guide foreign policy?
Yeah, not in a very popular place. That's for sure. And, you know, in the short run, we may not be able to do very much about this. I mean, I think back to the 1930s. We had an extremely articulate and effective president in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt. And he was largely unable to do much to try to address the nationalist, isolationist, you know, mood that captured the country in those days, and literally was unable to kind of mobilize the country until we were attacked in a major way at Pearl Harbor. Now, I hope and pray that isn't what's going to happen again in the future. But we should at least in the debate remind the American people, all right, about the limitations of each of these approaches. And while it may be appropriate after Iraq and Afghanistan that we pull in our horns a bit, that we think a little harder about how to get the Europeans and the Japanese to do more for their own defense, that we negotiate at least future trade agreements that are a little tougher in terms of, you know, what we expect in terms of access to foreign markets. Those are reasonable, I think, adjustments to the experiences that we've had over the past decade. But I would urge, you know, in the debate, I would simply make the point that, you know, if you don't try to influence the way the world is going, if you do less to influence the way the world is going, then the actions of others is going to have a greater influence on the way the world goes. And do you want the world to go the way that Vladimir Putin wants the world to go? I mean, he wants to roll back the liberal Western order in Europe. Do you want the kind of world that Xi Jinping wants in China? He's pursuing some very aggressive policies, military policies of his own in Asia, which are threatening, you know, some of our allies in that region, the Philippines and Japan. Do you want a world in which the influence of someone like the Ayatollah in Iran is greater in regions like the Middle East? So these are the costs of kind of being a little too eager to leave the world, assuming that somehow the world's going to take care of itself. Well, the world then evolves under the influence of others. And the United States is still the primary, you know, proponent of free societies and free markets in the world. I mean, we see the difficulties that the European Union is having now with Britain leaving the European Union. And the European Union has never been, you know, that effective or has never taken positions yet in common of any significance in the area of common security. So who's going to worry about the defense and the stability, even maintaining just the status quo of free societies in Europe? It's going to take, I think, a little more leadership on our part than maybe, you know, some of the population, at least at this point in time, thinks is necessary. So I'm for making the case that some adjustments are appropriate, but we're carrying them too far in some cases. I don't think we can afford, and we're going to run some real risks if we continue the policies of President Obama under President Clinton. If we have that kind of a policy for another 8 years, potentially we're going to accumulate problems in that direction as well. That is where more and more countries are going to sign agreements with us, but they won't pay much attention to them. They'll lull us, so to speak, into complacency while they, in fact, proceed to achieve their objectives outside those negotiations, as Iran, you could argue, has done. In the agreement, it secures a nuclear capability. It simply postpones it for 10 years. But basically, it has achieved what it was trying to achieve. And therefore, those kinds of agreements have their limits. So, you know, that's the kind of debate I would love to hear. And then let the American people decide. I mean, I am a Democrat with a little D, and I believe that, you know, the people ultimately get the right to make these choices. They can make mistakes, and they should be aware of when they made mistakes in the past. And I do think that the attitude of the American public in the 1930s was a bad mistake. Cost us heavily, the worst war we've ever been involved in the case of World War II. Of course, I would never want to see that happen again, and I don't think it will, but we should be at least aware of the shortcomings of any one of these traditions that we somehow or other may think now is the most appropriate one.
And so as you think about being able to make the case, are there any leading lights in politics or public opinion that you think are very effective spokespersons for this this sort of way of thinking, the conservative internationalism approach. And I'd be particularly interested if you see any people, you know, that might, you know, if you see any folks on the Democratic side of the House, as well
right.
as the Republican, because at least if I think back over politicians in the past, there were the Scoop Jacksons, obviously the
right.
Harry Truman, and perhaps even someone like Sam Nunn that might have been arguably a conservative internationalist. So are there any Democrats that fall to the camp? And then who do you see on the Republican side of the fence that you think,
right.
you know, advocate this point of view?
Yeah. Again, excellent observations, because we have to start thinking about how, you know, whatever tradition we want to follow at any given point in time, we have to try to figure out how that can be a nonpartisan or a bipartisan approach, because we can only be effective if we have, in fact, both key Republicans and key Democrats cooperating. I think also in the past, you mentioned some of the Democrats who in the past, Scoop Jackson, of course, was a critical player in the early development of the conservative internationalism that emerged under Ronald Reagan. Joe Lieberman, by the way, is another Democrat who has often argued for a no longer in office, but nevertheless often argued for a more muscular approach to a policy that would still be targeted on trying to nurture and to the extent we could incrementally expand freedom. So in terms of Republicans, and I'm trying to think too of sort of contemporary, you know, there are some Tim Kaine, maybe, who is a senator senator from Virginia in the Senate, who has, I think, some views about foreign policy that move in the direction of conservative internationalism, a little more muscular sort of handle on military matters. On the Republican side, I mean, I think this was, of course, the position in large measure that Mitt Romney took in the 2012 campaign, unsuccessfully, as we know. In this year's campaign, or in the campaign for the past year and now for the next several months, I had always hoped Marco Rubio had maybe rhetorically presented this position best. He lacked both the experience and the defense program that might have fit better the objectives that he was talking about. And he was, of course, speaking against the mood of the times, and so he really never caught on. I thought, in terms of my own preferences, I had always wished that somehow or other Marco Rubio and Scott Walker could team up, because Walker had demonstrated the ability in a blue state to implement red policies, by the way, the same way that Ronald Reagan had done in California in the 1960s and early 1970s. So, unfortunately, those candidates didn't resonate with the mood of the times. We have the candidates that we mentioned, neither of which I think is very close to kind of the conservative internationalist position. I'm hopeful that that others may emerge in time. Obviously, still have John McCain, who speaks, at least in this direction for the most part. But you really need some younger, fresher voices, I think, that come along and adapt this conservative internationalist position. By the way, one way we might do that is to be very clear about the fact that while we are committed to expanding freedom, we are not committed to do that everywhere at once, and we are willing to set clear priorities on where the battle for freedom is important. And I've suggested that we should maybe think about identifying countries that lie along the border of existing free countries as the ones that matter the most in the future battle for freedom. So they would be countries, for example, like Ukraine, Georgia, the Baltic states, certainly Poland, all right, that are potentially now threatened by authoritarianism on the border between free Europe and Russia. And then in Asia, the countries that are kind of, you know, in between a growing authoritarian China and a free Japan, and so far a free South Korea. So countries like, you know, what happens on the Korean Peninsula, what happens in Taiwan, what happens even in Hong Kong, are those are priority issues for us in terms of whether we are going to be able to expand freedom in the future or not. I would pay less attention, and I think we should pay less attention. We should hear out the nationalists on this point. Pay less attention to trying to spread freedom where it has a very low chance of succeeding. And that would be in the Middle East and in South Asia and in some other parts of the world where there are no neighboring strong democracies. There are no established alliances. There are no vibrant free markets. So we ought to, in the future, learn from both the Vietnam experience and from the Iraq and the Afghanistan experience that when we face threats in those countries or in countries like that, we deal with the threats, but then we don't stick around for 10, 20, 30 years trying to build democracies where there's very little, you know, chance that those democracies can take hold and can survive.
Well, Professor Now, we appreciate your comments. We've got about 15 minutes left for some Q&A from the audience. Will, I don't know if there's anyone in the queue that's interested in putting a question to Professor Now.
Well, to find the answer to that, we're going to have to open up the queue. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, just to reiterate, please enter star and then pound if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Now. We do have one question on the line, which we'll go to now. If you hit star and the pound at any point during this next question and answer, you will be next in line and we'll put you right on the phone. Let's go to our first caller.
This is Robert. Hi, this is Robert Barker in Atlanta calling. You use the word democracy a lot as being sort of correlative with freedom. But democracy doesn't necessarily, or it usually doesn't lead to freedom. It leads to sort of tyrannies of majorities, which is why the framers did not want democracy. Woodrow Wilson did the world a great disservice, I think, by trying to make the world safe for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't we be better off trying to ditch that term altogether and start talking about limited government and a republican form of government rather than democracy?
Well, yes, and that's the sense in which I think and I write about democracy. You will see a definition of it, by the way, in the book. And I think what you've defined is kind of referendum democracy or a pure majoritarian democracy. I mean, that's something which you're absolutely right, the Founding Fathers did not want, and which I don't think we would want either in this country or in other countries. But look, here's the essence, I think, of democratic government. I mean, first is the idea of opposing parties rotating peacefully in power through free and fair elections. All right, that's one. That's one principal characteristic of a democracy. Now, that's a feature that can be applied in almost any country. I mean, it applies today, for example, in Japan, although Japan is still struggling with this idea of an enduring opposition party. But they do now have an opposition party in that country. Obviously, a one-party democracy is not a real democracy. Now, to have free and fair elections, you need a second plank or a second aspect of democracy, and that is some protection of individual rights. Right. In our country, it's through the Bill of Rights, it's through customary law in Great Britain. It's done in other ways in Germany today, for example. But there needs to be some protection for individual rights to assemble, to free speech, to vote, obviously. All of these things are necessary in order for an opposing party to be able at some point in time to become a majority party or to become the governing party. Now, lastly, you need a system in which when your officials are elected through free and fair elections with appropriate protections for individual rights, they cannot be trumped or they cannot be overruled by a military establishment. So the military and all of your bureaucracies in a free country have to be subordinate to those freely elected officials. Now, those are features of a democracy that apply in the United States. They apply in many other countries. They are, I would argue, universal features, and therefore we can talk, as Woodrow Wilson did, although he didn't define democracy in this way. You're right about that. He had a much more majoritarian view of democracy. But they can be used to help us to understand what are the kinds of developments in other countries, political developments in other countries, that we should support and that ultimately, if necessary, defend if they're on these borders with existing free countries. So we can think about that in today in the context of Ukraine and Ukraine or Poland. Their countries far from being, you know, established and what we could call mature democracies. Maybe they're more like the United States was in the 1840s and 1850s, struggling to establish a durable system of parties rotating peacefully in power through free and fair elections. But I think it's important to think about it in that way, and it's very important to define our foreign policy in these terms. So I would urge us not to dispose of that terminology altogether in thinking about foreign policy.
Great.
Okay.
All right, we do have another question on the line now, so we'll go to that caller. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star and then the pound key. We will have time, I think, to take more than just this one question.
Hi, this is Brad Brown in Washington, D.C. I've heard what you've said relative to Trump, and I've heard him been described as kind of, you know, intellectually lazy. So, you know, I think that foreign policy is one of those places that requires kind of an inordinate amount of study. Is adding a guy like, in your mind, you know, Corker to the ticket significantly helpful to Trump? I mean, does that kind of bridge his problem there, or is that even not sufficient?
Yeah, good question. I mean, if Trump will listen to him, this is what we have trouble, you know, maybe understanding at this point. I'm a little bit leery of kind of accusing Trump of being intellectually lazy, because people accused Ronald Reagan of being intellectually lazy. And, you know, we have learned that Ronald Reagan knew a lot about what he was doing and had thought a lot about it. Now, I don't have the same sense, because I haven't seen the evidence, that Donald Trump has thought a long time and deeply about some of these issues. So in that sense, I would probably say he's intellectually less prepared for this position than Ronald Reagan was. And I keep looking for evidence that he will start getting more serious, in more belabored, maybe is the right word. That is, more anguish to some extent in his discussion of some of his policies. I mean, I'll take one example, which is not in the military field, but it's on the tip of my mind, and that is his trade policies. I wish that he would address the question, for example, of, if we put tariffs on these products that you're talking about, why wouldn't other countries do the same thing? Or if we want to take jobs back from overseas and bring them back to America, why wouldn't other countries do the same thing? He must know that some 12 million people, are 8.5% of our workforce, are employed by foreigners, by foreign companies in the United States. Now, this is just a policy to march us back to the 1930s. So let him work me through that. I'd like to see him tell me how I'm wrong in that assessment of his policies on trade. I don't know whether we'll get that in a campaign. But I would urge the media to go and not to take the attitude that Trump doesn't know what he's talking about, but to go back and see what all he said about these things in the past. Let's try to really discover what his deep thinking is about the world. We may find out he doesn't think deeply about anything. Well, okay, but let's don't start with that assumption. Let's start with the assumption that there may be something there for us to go back and to look for. And I hope that would help us tremendously if the next couple of months we got all sorts of serious studies of things that he has said and discussions others have had with him about these various problems, and we could maybe then get him to be, as I say, more belabored, more deliberate in his discussion of his policies towards these issues.
All right, we have no more questions on the line. I want to make a final call here. If you'd like to ask a question to Professor now, please hit star and then the pound key. Matthew, I think I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to thank the last caller. And if we've got time, I think, for one last call, if someone wants to raise a question. Otherwise, I'll exercise the moderator's privilege and ask my own.
Well, I don't see anyone on the line now, so I think you should go ahead and do that.
So, Professor, now we were speaking a little bit before we got on the call about how to engage young people in these issues. And sort of how do you educate folks to think about these issues in a disciplined way? And if you were giving advice, I mean, obviously you're in the academy and you think about how to instruct young people. If you were trying to put together a recipe for parents or educators to encourage young people to think critically about America's role in the world, what are some of the things you'd be saying that, you know, a student should be doing or studying as they prepare themselves to eventually be leaders for this country?
Yeah, it's a very important question. And I think the first thing I would say to students, and I say to my students, is take into account the possibility that you might be wrong. Now, that's a great starting place for inquiring into other points of view, and for searching for more and more evidence. Always consider the possibility that you might be wrong. I mean, if we started with that kind of intellectual modesty or partisan modesty, we might begin to make some headway in terms of listening to one another, recognizing that there are alternative ways to interpret facts, that facts don't clarify issues definitively. They may, for the moment, I mean, there was a time when we thought that, you know, the world was governed by Newtonian physics, by Newtonian mechanics, but then along it came quantum mechanics and said that the world was made up very differently than we understood in the case of quantum mechanics. Now, which is the real world? So in politics, what is the real interpretation, in this case, let's say, of Donald Trump? Well, there may be no real interpretation. There may simply be alternative interpretations, and we have to work with them until such time as we find new evidence that reveals a third possibility. And by the way, that's what modern-day physics is trying to do, trying to find some third possibility that incorporates both Newtonian physics and quantum physics. And so in the universities, parents should really inquire as to whether or not their young people are being exposed to alternative points of view about everything. So even things on which we think the issue is closed, and the subject of climate change comes to my mind, invite criticism of climate change. If it's so completely certain, then criticism should not matter. It should be easily disposed of. Let people talk. We're having this problem on campuses today of ruling out talk of various kinds. You know, it's called hate speech or any kind of speech that might offend somebody. This is, of course, absolutely going in the wrong direction. You don't want to hurt anyone unnecessarily, but you shouldn't send anyone to college who doesn't want to be offended. Ideas are intended to offend, and the best place to deal with them is in an open public square, is in an open forum. And that's why, as you mentioned, we were talking about the societies like the Federalist Society and the Alexander Hamilton Society, which is trying to do what at the undergraduate level, what the Federalist Society did on law campuses. We emphasize debates. We emphasize alternative points of view. We emphasize, you know, lots of discussions where people feel free to express their point of view. And I've found that if you do that, maybe in smaller groups rather than in big, you know, auditoriums where protests that lend themselves to protests, you find students talking very honestly. And often, if they're going to introduce something that might be offensive, because let's say they're against transgender bathrooms, they'll kind of start by saying, "Look, I don't want to hurt anybody. And I really don't, and I understand there are a lot of people here who may differ with me on this, but here's the way I believe about that. I just happen to believe that, you know, in this case, sexual orientation is determined by nature." And so they make their case and let others then respond. Gosh, we can do that. We're a free people. We're an intelligent people. We're a more and more educated people. There will be plenty of people around us trying to exploit the situation, and sometimes I put the media in that category because they're looking for the sensational. They're looking for something that will help them to get your attention and therefore get advertising revenue when it goes on television. And that's okay. We've always had a partisan media and a competitive media in this country, going all the way back to the origins of the Republic. They have to be a part of it. But our educational community has a special responsibility, I think, to make students aware and to help students understand alternative points of view, and maybe to encourage the media to present alternative points of view. Don't just present one that seems to be conclusive in your mind. And I see more and more editorializing in reporting. It's terrible. I don't know where reporters are being trained, but if they're being trained at places like the School of Journalism at Columbia University, they better change that training, because they are making arguments in their reporting articles on the front page. And that's, I think, really unfortunate, even though, as I say, newspapers, at least editorially, have always been partisan one way or the other. That's a great tradition in this country and in most free countries.
Well, I think we are just a little bit past our hour, so before I turn over to Will to close this out, I just wanted to thank you again, Professor Now, for the conversation today. Again, for those that are interested, the basis of today's discussion was Professor Now's book, Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan, and a new paperback version of it was issued August of last year with the new preface by Professor Now. So if you found this discussion interesting, obviously you'll get a lot more detail and understanding by reading the book, and I would encourage you to do so. And so again, thank you, Professor Now. And with that, Will, I will turn it over to you to close this out.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for also excellent preparations for the discussion. The questions were really good.
Great.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hyman and Professor Now. This was a great program. Thank you to everyone who called in and asked their questions and was a part of it. We look forward to having you all again on another Teleform call in the near future. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.